supplies. He added a book, tested the weight of his pack, and took it out again. The sun was already high, although the valley was still in shadow. I could spend another night here, he thought, but the oasis might not be safe now that El Patrón was gone. Matt shouldered the backpack, tied extra water bottles to his belt, and set off through the grape arbor. He would go on, as Tamlin had, without looking back. The first part of the trail was easy. Matt had been over it many times. Soon, however, he came to a canyon choked with bushes. He had to break his way through. The dust of the leaves covered him from head to toe and found its way into his lungs. He had to rest in a dry gully to regain his breath. Only an hour had passed. If the rest of the journey went like this, he wouldn't reach Aztlan for a month. Matt went through the backpack. In an inside pocket, he found an inhaler. The relief it brought his tortured lungs was pure heaven. He also found a wicked-looking machete in a leather sheath. I could have saved myself a lot of trouble if I'd looked earlier, he thought. After a rest, Matt hacked his way through the bushes. It gave him a savage pleasure to get even with the plants that had scratched his arms and face all morning. When he reached the end of the valley, he was confronted by a high granite cliff. Matt checked the map. There it was, with a red line going straight to the top. It was higher than anything he'd ever attempted to climb. Matt looked for another way to proceed, but the map was firm on this point. Only way out. You can do it, said Tamlin's note. Matt stared up at the impossibly distant bushes peeking over the top of the cliff until he was dizzy. The only good thing was that he didn't have to boost Celia ahead of him. Matt inched from crevice to crevice until his legs began to tremble with fatigue. Halfway up, he thought he couldn't move another inch. He hugged the granite face and wondered how long he could stay there before exhaustion forced him to let go. He'd fall into jagged rocks. He'd die there. He might as well have let his heart be harvested by doctors. A shadow passed briefly over him, and after a moment, it came back. Only one thing cast a shadow on a cliff in such a deserted place. Matt was suddenly filled with rage. It was as though it came from some deep place, like lava in a volcano. He no longer felt exhausted or discouraged or anything else except a towering fury to survive. He pulled himself up, foothold by foothold, crag by crag, until he wriggled over the top and lay panting and surprised by his feet. Matt looked up into the blinding blue sky and heard the leathery flap of wings as the bird turned in the air. I win, you ugly good-for-nothing buzzard, thought Matt. He smiled. He sounded just like El Patrón. Matt celebrated with a bottle of water and a package of cookies. He threw a rock at the turkey buzzard. The map showed he'd come about 5 miles, and there were 5 more to go. The sun was bending to the west, so he might not make it to the border before dark. Matt wasn't particularly worried. He had plenty of food, and he felt enormously good after his battle with the cliff. He traveled on to the top of a ridge. The going was much easier, and the view was spectacular. Tamlin had included small binoculars among the supplies, so Matt stopped frequently to look back at Opium. The land toward Aztlan was still blocked by the mountains. He could see the long, flat poppy fields and even a brown smudge that might have been a group of egrets. He saw the water purification plant and storehouses for food and fertilizer. The red tile roofs of the mansion spread out in a patch of intense green. Matt felt a strange sensation in the pit of his stomach. It was, he realized, sorrow. There, on the high ridge of the Ajo Mountains, Matt gave himself over to grief. He wept for Celia, trapped in the stables, and for Tamlin, who was trapped in a different way. He wasted no tears on the Alagrangs or their slaves, Felicia, Fanny, and Emilia. But he wept for El Patrón, who deserved pity less than anyone, but who was closer to Matt than anyone in the world. In an odd way, it felt as though El Patrón were still alive, and in one sense, he was, for Matt still existed. As long as he survived, El Patrón had not vanished from the world. Matt camped at the top of the ridge. The recent rains had filled hollows in the rocks, and the little folds of the mountain were green with bear grass. desert mallow spread out peach-colored blooms in pockets of soil, and everywhere late-blooming cliff roses swarmed with bees. Matt wasn't afraid, although he saw more animals than he had ever observed on his travels with Tamlin. White-tailed deer fed on bushes in the late afternoon sun. He saw a buck rub its antlers on a tree, perhaps to sharpen them, or perhaps simply because they itched. Matt didn't know. He saw a group of coatis running with their tails in the air and their long noses pointed along the ground. Everything seemed alive. Everything scurried, flew, dug, nibbled, or chattered. Frogs cheeped from an unseen waterhole. A rock squirrel whistled when a red-tailed hawk drifted by. A mockingbird sat on the topmost branch of a mesquite and performed every song Matt had ever heard, plus a few extra the bird must have composed himself. Most of all, it was the wild music that impressed Matt. It did the same thing that playing the piano had done when he was frightened and lonely. It took him into another world where only beauty existed and where he was safe from hatred and disappointment and death. He stayed up a long time, watching the distant lights of Opium. There weren't many. The mansion sat by itself in a sea of dark. The factories, storehouses, and Egypt pens were all hidden. The air was so still, the Egypts had probably been driven into the fields to sleep. Matt heard no sound from the far plain. It might have been a painting, instead of a real place. Nearby, he heard the hoot of a great horned owl, and the incessant chirp of crickets. The mountain was darker than the plain, but it was alive, and it was real. Matt slept well, and he felt strong and confident in the morning. Opium was covered by a ground fog, as it often was in the fall. He couldn't see anything but a white haze stretching from horizon to horizon. With a last look at the map, Matt started along the trail. It dipped up and down, gradually leading up to a pass between two hills. He heard a noise from one of the high meadows, like someone hitting a baseball. It happened again and again. It couldn't really be people playing baseball up there, he knew, with only the hawks and turkey buzzards to watch. As he got closer, the sound became more like someone smacking a pair of ripe watermelons together. Matt cautiously peered around a bush and saw two bighorn sheep thunder at each other like a pair of farm trucks. They crashed head-on, reeled away, and trotted off. After a few moments, they repeated the performance. A group of ewes grazed among the rocks as though they couldn't be bothered to watch. Matt was so delighted, he laughed out loud. Then, of course, the sheep skittered to safety, making huge leaps as they bounded from rock to rock. As Matt approached the cleft at the top of the mountains, he began to hear another puzzling noise. It was like the roar of fire in Celia's stove. It got louder and louder, and now Matt could pick out individual sounds. The grinding of machinery, the blast of horns, even, incredibly, music. He stepped through the pass into another world. The same quiet hills lay below him, with hawks patrolling wooded valleys between shoulders of rock. But beyond them lay a seething mass of factories and skyscrapers. He saw roadways not only on the ground, but also going up in wide spirals among the buildings. A sea of hovercrafts restlessly prowled the air. The buildings stretched on as far as Matt could see, which wasn't far because a smudgy brown haze covered everything. It was from here that the booming, clanking, thundering noises came, and it surprised Matt so much, he sat down on the trail to think. The sun was directly overhead. Matt fished out the hat Tamlin had provided. So this was Aztlan. In all Matt's imaginings, it had been nothing like this. He had taken Celia's tales about the maquiladoras and El Patrón's stories about Durango and mixed them with episodes of El Látigo Negro. What came out was a hodgepodge of factories, primitive huts, and fabulous ranches owned by evil tycoons who had pretty daughters. How could people live in all that noise, he thought. How could they breathe the air? There wasn't a fence for as far as he could see, but there was a line of poles that could have supported a fence. The land on the opium side of the border was deserted. It was as though someone had put up a big sign saying, Danger. Radioactive. Matt went back over the mountain pass to the meadow where the bighorn sheep had tried to brain each other. He ate a small lunch of beef jerky and dry cheese. He couldn't stay here. The rainy season in the Ajo Mountains was brief, and Matt had a very clear idea of how soon the little frog ponds and hidden grottos would dry out. Equally, he couldn't return to the mansion. The only way out was the border of Aztlan.
"You can do it," he imagined Tamlin saying.
"I guess I have to," thought Matt, turning to look one last time at the quiet meadow, the white plumes of bear grass, and the black-throated sparrows flitting through the trees. He slid down parts of the hill where the ground was steep and sandy. He arrived at the bottom, hot and dusty and itching from dozens of spines he had collected from a chola cactus on the way down. He crouched in the shade of a rock to drink the last of his water. Matt found the spines impossible to remove. They seemed to burrow deeper into his skin when he tried to pinch them out. And somewhere along the way, he'd torn his pants and one of the straps on the backpack. Matt observed the border through binoculars. What he saw was every bit as ugly as it sounded. A row of factories chugged smoke into the air. Behind them, on the border itself, was a tangle of cast-off machinery and tanks that seeped a black liquid onto the ground. Pools of the stuff dotted the narrow space between the buildings and the line of poles. Then, something much closer moved across Matt's field of view. He adjusted the lenses. It was a man on a horse. It was a member of the farm patrol. Moving the glasses around, he saw more of them. Matt shrank back into the rocks. The farm patrol must have gone back to work after the wake. Had they seen him come slipping and sliding down the mountain? He was afraid to move. He was afraid not to. Fortunately, the hollow where Matt was hiding was deep. After a tense half hour or so, he guessed the farm patrol had seen nothing. Or perhaps they were merely waiting for him to get thirsty and come out. Matt did get thirsty, horribly so, as the hours went by. He counted 6 men. They rode slowly back and forth. At no time was the border deserted, and at no time was it possible for Matt to run the remaining few hundred yards to freedom. The sun dipped to the west. Shadows lengthened. Matt sucked on a stone to keep from feeling thirsty. The sun set. The shadow of night rose, dividing the eastern sky into pale blue above and gray below, with a rosy border where the sunlight still shone on a haze of dust in the air. Suddenly, a commotion broke out. A group of men burst from one of the junkyards and ran across the border. The instant they passed the line of poles, sirens went off. The farm patrol galloped to intercept them. At once, Matt was off in the other direction. It hadn't taken him a second to react. This was his chance. He raced across the ground. To his left, he heard shouts and a loud crack, accompanied by a flash of light. Matt had seen this weapon at El Patron's birthday party. It was a super stun gun that fried the hair on an illegal's head and stopped his heart cold. Most of the time, the illegal's heart started again, so he could be turned into an eejit. Matt heard horses' hooves pounding. He didn't try to see how many men had turned to follow him. His only chance was to reach the border, and he bounded with an agility that would have impressed a bighorn sheep. He saw the body of a horse approaching. Matt swung the binoculars at the animal's head and sent it veering to one side. The rider pulled it up and forced it to turn. The poles were close. Matt saw the ground ahead change from dirt to cement. He put on an extra burst of speed, but the farm patroller grabbed Matt's backpack and reined in his horse. Matt undid the snap holding the waistband and slid out of the straps. The change in speed sent him stumbling across the border into one of the oily black pools where he fell on his stomach and skidded out the other side in a plume of goo. Matt sat up, frantically wiping his eyes. He saw the farm patroller right away and looked down to see he would have no trouble convincing the Aztlanos he was a refugee. He had no backpack, no money, and he was covered from head to toe in black slime. La Vida Nueva. Chapter 26. The Lost Boys.
¡Qué coraje! What spirit that kid has!
A man said. Matt wiped away the goo dripping off his hair. He saw a pair of uniformed men approaching from amid ruined machinery and tanks.
Hey kid, ¿cómo te llamas? What's your name? Asked one of them.
Matt was stumped for a moment. He certainly couldn't tell the truth.
Matt Ortega, he said, swiping the music teacher's name.
You're a real fighter, said the border guard. I thought he had you when he grabbed the backpack. Did your family go over tonight?
No, my family.
Now that the excitement was over, Matt felt the reaction set in. He hugged himself and his teeth chattered.
Hey, the guard said kindly. You don't need to explain now. You just had the beans scared out of you.
God, I got scared watching you. Come inside where you can have a bath and something to eat.
Matt followed carefully so he wouldn't slip on the cement. His body was covered in sludge, and his stomach was in knots over the narrow escape. The guards led him to a large cement bathroom with showers along the walls. They gave him a brush and a chunk of green soap.
Take one of the clean bodysuits from the bin, one of them instructed him.
This is like a dream, Matt thought, as he scrubbed and re-scrubbed himself in the steamy shower. He'd been afraid of his welcome in Aslan, but these men treated him like a guest. They didn't seem a bit surprised to see him. Matt found an olive drab jumpsuit that didn't look too bad. The cloth was as rough as a floor brush, but it would help him fit in with the others. He could pass as human. When he emerged, he was seated at a table and given a plate of tortillas and beans by a man in a black uniform with the emblem of a beehive on one sleeve.
Thank you. This is very nice, Matt said.
Oh, we have an aristocrat here, said one of the border guards. When was the last time someone said thank you to a keeper, Raúl?
About the time America discovered Columbus, said Raúl.
He pulled up a chair.
Okay, kid. What were you doing on the frontera?
Matt, between mouthfuls of beans, gave him the story Tamlin had prepared. His parents had been taken by the farm patrol. He got scared and ran back across the border. He wanted to go to San Luis.
That's really tough, losing your parents like that. Do you come from San Luis? Said Raúl.
I have a friend there, said Matt, stumbling over how exactly to describe Maria.
The man shrugged.
What kind of work can you do?
Work? Matt was confused. He knew how to run an opium empire, but he didn't think that was what the man wanted to hear.
I can play the piano, he said at last.
Raúl laughed out loud.
Now I know he's an aristocrat, said the other border guard.
Don't get us wrong, said Raúl, noticing Matt's unhappy expression. We like art and music, but in the new Aztlán, we don't have time for hobbies. We have to contribute to the general good of the people.
It's hard, but it's fair, the other man said. So, if you have a special skill like balancing magnetic coils or running a positronic purifier, please tell us.
Positronic purifier, thought Matt. I don't even know what it is. He racked his brain. I studied water purification, he said at last. It wasn't quite true. Matt had toured the water purification plant, but he thought he remembered enough to be useful.
Those plants are automated, said the border guard.
Wait, I'm getting an idea, said Raúl.
Stomp on it before it gets away, the guard said.
No, really, the plankton factory in San Luis can always use new workers. That's something like water purification. And it's where the kid wants to go.
The men seemed to think this was a brilliant plan. And Matt, who had no idea what they were talking about, said the plankton factory sounded fine. It was in San Luis, after all. He could leave right away and find his way to the convent of Santa Clara. Matt spent the night in the guardhouse, and in the morning, Raúl took him to a large gray building with high windows covered with iron bars.
You're in luck, chico, he said. We got a hovercraft going to San Luis tomorrow.
He unlocked a metal door that led into a dimly lit hallway. A pair of border guards lounged at a table in front of another door made of reinforced glass. They were playing a game Matt had never seen. Tiny men seemed to hang in midair over the table, along with trees, buildings, and a pot bubbling on a fire. It was the pot and fire that enchanted Matt. They were so realistic, he could even hear water splattering onto the flames. About half of the tiny men were dressed in animal skins and carried spears. The other half were clad in monk's robes. The border guards wore silver gloves and moved the game pieces by waving their fingers.
Another one for San Luis, said Raúl.
The men grudgingly turned off the game.
Where did the picture go? Said Matt.
Haven't you ever seen a hollow game, kid?
Of course I have, Matt lied. He didn't want to arouse suspicion.
Oh, I get it, the border guard said. You haven't seen this game before. That's because it's so old. It's all the crotting government sends us.
Don't use language like that in front of a kid, said Raul.
Sorry, said the guard. He turned on the game, and the tiny men appeared again. See, those are the cannibals, and these are the missionaries. The aim is for the cannibals to push the missionaries into the cooking pot.
And the missionaries? Matt asked.
They have to push the cannibals into the church, but first they have to baptize them.
Matt watched, fascinated, as a tiny missionary held down a yelling cannibal and sprinkled water on his head. So that's what baptism was. It looks like fun, he said.
Sure, if you haven't played it a couple thousand times.
The man turned the game off and unlocked the glass door for Raul and Matt to pass through. Why are all the doors locked? Matt asked.
The orderly production of resources is vital to the general good of the people, said Raul.
That's a very weird thing to say, Matt thought. However, his attention was riveted on a room full of boys working at tables. They all stopped what they were doing and turned to look at Matt. He had never played with children. He'd never been to school or played sports. And he'd never had a friend his own age, except Maria. The reaction of most people to him had been hatred. Thus, the experience of suddenly being thrust into a crowd of boys was like being dumped into a pool of piranhas. Matt assumed they were going to hurt him. He froze into a karate stance Tam Lin had shown him. The boys surged forward, all talking at once.
What's your name? Where are they sending you? Got any money?
Raul, perhaps noticing Matt's odd position, crowded them back.
Orale, moros. Okay, kids. His name's Matt, and he needs to be left alone for a while. He just lost his parents in Dreamland.
The boys went back to the tables, but they eyed Matt curiously, and one or two of them smiled and tried to entice him over. Matt stood next to the door while Raul walked around the room, commenting on the boys' work. Some were fitting small bits of machinery together. Others wove strips of plastic into sandals. Still others measured powder into capsules and counted the finished pills into bottles. Raul stopped by a large boy who was sanding a curved piece of wood.
We don't have time for hobbies, Chacho. The orderly production of resources is vital to the general good of the people.
Crot the good of the people,
muttered Chacho, still sanding the wood.
If Raul was angered by this curse, and Matt had no doubt it was a curse, although he didn't know what it meant, the man didn't show it.
He took the wood from Chacho's hands.
Attention to the welfare of the nation is the highest virtue to which a citizen can aspire.
Yeah, right, said Chacho.
Work is freedom. Freedom is work. It's hard, but it's fair.
It's hard, but it's fair, chanted the rest of the boys. It's hard, but it's fair.
They banged out the rhythm on the tables, getting louder and rowdier until Raul stilled them by raising his hands.
I'm glad to see you in high spirits, he said, smiling. You may think I'm a boring old keeper, but someday you'll understand the importance of these lessons.
He led Matt to the middle of the room.
This boy is going to San Luis. I want you to make him welcome, but don't push him if he wants to be alone. He's just been through a terrible loss.
Raul's exit was done smoothly, with the door closed and locked almost before Matt was aware of it. Why did they have to be locked in? And what was a keeper? It was the second time Matt had heard the word. He glared at the boys, whose work slowed now that they weren't being watched. El Patron always said it was important to establish your authority before anyone had a chance to question it. Matt walked toward the tables as though he owned the place.
Want to join us?
Said a skinny little kid who was making up pills. Matt looked grandly around the room. He nodded curtly.
You can help if you want, the kid offered. My advice is to sit on your butt while you still have the chance, said Chacho from across the room.
The big boy was twisting plastic strips into sandals. Matt walked slowly to the sandal-making table. El Patron said you should never look anxious or needy. People always took advantage of those who were anxious or needy.
Why is that? Inquired Matt, looking down at the tangle of plastic strips.
Because the keepers are going to work your butt off tomorrow, said Chacho.
He was a large, rough-looking boy with big hands and black hair slicked back like the feathers on a duck. I thought I was going to San Luis.
Oh, you are.
So am I, and Fidelito.
Chacho pointed at the skinny kid who looked only about 8 years old. But you can bet we're going to work before we get on the hovercraft, while we're on the hovercraft, and after we get off the crotting hovercraft. You'll see. So Matt wandered around and watched the various chores the boys were doing. He settled by Fidelito, who was ecstatic to gain the approval of the newcomer. After a while, Matt could see why. Fidelito was the neediest kid in the room, and so of course everyone pushed him around.
What kind of pills are those? Matt asked.
Vitamin B, said Fidelito. They're supposed to be good for you, but if you eat 10 or 12 of them, you get sick.
What a dope, Chacho said. Why would anybody eat a dozen vitamin pills?
I was hungry, Fidelito said.
Matt was startled. You mean they don't feed you here?
Sure they do, if you produce enough work. I'm just not very fast.
You're not very big, Matt said, feeling sorry for the earnest little boy.
That doesn't matter, Fidelito explained. Everyone's supposed to have the same output. As long as we're here, we're equal.
It's hard, but it's fair, intoned Chacho from across the room.
The other boys picked up the chant, banging the tables until the whole room rocked. One of the border guards told them to shut up through a loudspeaker.
Did you see your parents taken?
Asked Fidelito when the hubbub died down.
Cállate! Shut up! Let him get used to it!
Several voices cried. But Matt raised his hand for silence, as he'd seen Raúl do. To his great pleasure, the boys obeyed. There really was something to El Patrón's methods of gaining power.
It happened yesterday morning, he said, improvising.
Matt remembered the crowd of illegals who had distracted the farm patrol.
I saw a flash of light. Papa shouted for me to go back to the border. I saw Mama fall down, and then a man grabbed my backpack. I slipped out of the straps and ran.
I know what that flash of light was, said a sad-faced boy. It's a kind of gun, and it kills you dead. Mi mama.
His voice choked, and he didn't say any more. Fidelito put his head down on the table.
Have other people lost their parents? Stammered Matt.
He'd been about to create a dramatic story about his escape. Now it seemed a heartless thing to do.
We all have, said Chacho. I guess you haven't figured it out. This is an orfanatorio, an orphanage. The state is our family now. That's why the border guards wait along the frontera. They catch the kids of rockheads who make a run for it and turn them over to the keepers.
Mi abuelita wasn't a rockhead,
said Fidelito from the cradle of his arms.
Your grandma, oh heck, Fidelito, said Chacho. She was too old to run to the United States. You know that. Well, I'm sure she loved you, he added as the little boy sniffled.
So, you see how it is, Chacho told Matt. We're all part of the crotting production of resources for the crotting good of the people.
Don't let Raúl hear you, someone said.
I'd like to tattoo it on my butt for him to read, said Chacho, going back to the tangle of plastic strips on his table.
Chapter 27. A Five-Legged Horse. The rest of the day, from Matt's point of view, went very well. He drifted from group to group, listening to conversations and storing up information. In case someone were to wonder why he was so ignorant, he didn't ask many questions. He learned that the keepers were in charge of people who couldn't take care of themselves. They took in the orphans, the homeless, the insane, and molded them into good citizens. The orphans were known as lost boys and lost girls, and they lived in different buildings. Matt couldn't figure out why everyone seemed to hate the keepers, although no one except Chacho said so directly. Raúl seemed nice enough. Matt also learned that the country of opium was called Dreamland here. No one really knew what lay beyond its borders. There were many stories of zombie slaves and a vampire king who lived in a castle. The chupacabras haunted its mountains and occasionally crossed over into Aztlán to drink the blood of goats. Boys who had not seen their parents taken believed they had made it to the United States. Several boys assured Matt they were only waiting for their parents to send for them. Then they would all be rich and happy in the golden paradise that lay beyond Dreamland. Matt doubted it. The farm patrol was very efficient, and besides, El Patrón had told him just as many people ran away from the United States as toward it,
If a golden paradise had ever lain to the north, it wasn't there anymore. Matt helped Fidelito make pills. It seemed monstrously unfair that the little boy was deprived of food simply because he was slower than the larger boys. Fidelito responded with such adoration that Matt began to regret his good deed. The kid reminded him a little of Furball. They had a half-hour break for lunch. First, the guards checked everyone's work output for the morning. Then they brought in a steaming cauldron of beans and handed out tortillas. Before anyone was allowed to eat, the boys had to recite the 5 principles of good citizenship and the 4 attitudes leading to right mindfulness. The food was doled out according to whether a boy had reached his quota or not. Fidelito looked at Matt with shining eyes as his bowl was filled to the brim. After lunch, the work started again. Matt helped Fidelito for a while, then switched to Chacho's table for variety. He very quickly figured out the pattern he was supposed to weave. "Enjoy it while you can," grunted Chacho. "Enjoy what?" said Matt, holding up a finished sandal. "The thrill of moving from one job to another. Once you settle in, the keepers will let you do only one thing. It's supposed to be efficient." Matt considered this information as he continued to weave plastic. "Can't you ask for something else?" Chacho laughed. "Sure, you can ask. You won't get it, though. Raul says worker bees do the best they can with whatever job they're given. That's his way of saying tough toenails, sucker." Matt thought a while longer. "What was that piece of wood you were working on when I arrived?" For a moment, Matt thought the boy wasn't going to answer. Chacho twisted a strip of plastic so viciously, it broke. He had to start over with a new one. "It took me weeks to find that wood," he said at last. "I think it was from an old packing crate. I polished it and sanded it. I was going to find more pieces and glue them together." Chacho fell silent again. "And make what?" Matt urged. "Promise you won't tell?" "Of course." "A guitar." That was the last answer Matt expected. Chacho had such clumsy-looking hands, he didn't seem capable of playing a musical instrument. "Do you know how to play?" "Not as well as my father. He taught me to make guitars, though, and I'm pretty good at that." "Was he taken in dreamland?" said Matt. "Caramba! Do you think I belong with the rest of these losers? Me encarcelaron por feo. I was locked up for being ugly. I'm no orphan. My dad's living in the United States. He's got so much money, he can't even fit it into his pockets, and he's gonna send for me as soon as he buys a house." Chacho looked absolutely furious, but Matt could tell from his voice that tears weren't far below the surface. Matt worked on his sandal, not looking at Chacho. He noticed the other boys were absorbed in their work, too. They knew, they had to know, that Chacho's father wasn't going to send for anyone anytime soon. But only Matt understood what had really happened to him. Chacho's father was bending and cutting poppies all day in the hot sun. And on still, breathless nights, he was sleeping in the fields to keep from being suffocated by the bad air from the pits. In the evening, the lunchtime ritual was repeated. The food was exactly the same. Afterward, the boys washed dishes, tidied up the workroom, and moved the tables to one side. From a storage room, they dragged out beds and fitted them on top of one another to form bunks 3 levels high.
"Put Fidelito's bed on the bottom," someone told Matt.
"Which one is it?" asked Matt.
"Smell the mattress," said Chacho.
"I can't help it,"
the little boy protested. They were marched into a communal shower by the border guards. Matt had never seen anyone naked outside the art classes on TV. He found it embarrassing. He kept his right foot planted on the floor so no one could see the writing that proclaimed him a clone. He was very glad to shrug on a coarse nightshirt and retreat to the workroom, now bedroom. "Do we go to sleep now?" he asked.
"Now we get the bedtime story," said Chacho.
The boys seemed energized by something. They clustered around a bunk bed under a window, and Chacho put his ear to the wall. After a moment, he pointed at the window and nodded. Fidelito climbed the bunk bed like a little monkey and lifted his nightshirt. This was his moment of glory.
"Voy a enseñarle la mapa mundi," he announced.
"I'm going to show him the map of the world," thought Matt. Show who? And what did he mean by the map of the world? Fidelito stuck his skinny backside between the bars of the high window and waggled it. A minute later, Matt heard Raúl's voice say, "One of these days I'm going to bring a slingshot." Fidelito scrambled off the bed to the cheers of the rest of the boys.
"I'm the only one small enough to fit,"
he said, swaggering around like a bantam rooster. When Raúl entered, he said nothing at all about being mooned. He pulled up a chair, and the boys settled on the bunk beds to listen. The title of his talk was "Why Individualism is Like a Five-Legged Horse." Raúl explained that things went smoothly only when people worked together. They decided on a goal and then helped one another achieve it. "What would happen," the keeper asked all the boys, "if you were rowing a boat and half of you wanted to go one way and the other half another?" He waited expectantly, and after a while, someone put up his hand and said, "We'd go in circles."
"Very good," said Raúl, beaming at his audience. "We all have to paddle together to reach the shore."
"What if we don't want to reach the shore?" Chacho said.
"A very good question," said the keeper. "Can anyone tell us what would happen if we stayed out in the boat for days and days?"
He waited. "We'd starve to death," a boy said.
"There's your answer, Chacho," said Raúl. "We'd all starve to death. That brings me to the problem of the five-legged horse. A horse runs very well on four legs. It's what he's made for. But suppose he grew a fifth leg that only wanted to please itself. The other four legs would be running and running, but the fifth leg, which we'll call individualism, would want to walk slowly to enjoy a beautiful meadow, or it might want to take a nap. Then the poor animal would fall over. That's why we take that unhappy horse to a vet and have the fifth leg cut off. It may seem harsh, but we've all got to pull together in the new Aztlán, or we'll all wind up lying in the dirt. Does anyone have a question?"
Raúl waited a long time. Finally, Matt put up his hand and said, "Why don't you put a computer chip in the horse's brain? Then it wouldn't matter how many legs it had."
A gasp went around the room. "Are you saying..."
The keeper stopped, as though he couldn't believe what he was hearing.
"Are you suggesting we turn the horse into a zombie?"
"I don't see much difference between that and sawing off the extra leg," said Matt. "What you're after is a horse that works hard and doesn't waste time looking at flowers."
"This is great," Chacho said. "But you... don't you see the difference?"
Raúl was so outraged he could hardly speak. "We recite the five principles of good citizenship and the four attitudes leading to right mindfulness every time we want to eat," explained Matt. "You keep telling us the orderly production of resources is vital to the general good of the people. It's obvious we're supposed to follow the rules and not walk slowly through meadows. But horses aren't as smart as people. It makes sense to program them with computer chips." Matt thought this was a brilliant argument, and he couldn't see why the keeper was so upset. El Patrón would have seen the logic of it in an instant.
"I can see we have our work cut out with you," Raúl said in a tight voice. "I can see we have a nasty little aristocrat who needs to be educated about the will of the people."
Matt was amazed at the man's reaction. The keeper had asked for questions. In fact, he'd almost demanded them.
"Well," said Raúl, brushing off his uniform as though he'd touched something dirty, "the sooner this nasty little aristocrat goes to the plankton factory, the better. That's all I can say."
And he flounced out of the room. Instantly, all the boys crowded around Matt.
"Wow, you showed him," they cried.
"You mooned him even better than I did,"
said Fidelito, bouncing up and down on a bed.
"He didn't even make us recite the five principles of good citizenship and the four attitudes leading to right mindfulness," exulted a boy.
"Heck, add you down as a wuss," said Chacho. "You've got more nerve than a herd of bulls."
"What? What did I do?" said Matt, completely bewildered.
"You only told him the keepers were trying to turn us into a bunch of crots."
Late that night, Matt lay on a top bunk and went over the events of the day. He didn't know how much trouble he was in or what kind of revenge to expect. He didn't dislike Raúl. He only thought the man was an idiot. Matt realized he'd better walk carefully around people who took offense at mere words. What harm could words do? Tam Lin loved a good argument. The more spirited, the better. He said it was like doing push-ups in your brain. Matt felt his right foot under the scratchy wool blanket. This was his one weakness, and he despaired of keeping it hidden. Tam Lin might have said there was no difference between humans and clones, but everything in Matt's experience argued against it. Humans hated clones. It was the natural order of things, and Raoul could use it to destroy him. No one must ever see the tattoo that tied Matt to Dreamland, and to the vampire who lived in its castle. Vampire, thought Matt. El Patron would have enjoyed that description. He loved to inspire fear. Matt had added a few more crumbs to the stash of information he was accumulating about this new world in which he found himself. An aristocrat was the lowest form of life, a parasite who expected honest peasants to be his slaves. A crot, the deadliest insult anyone could utter, was a simple, harmless eejit, like the thousands who had cut grass, washed floors, and tended poppies as far back as Matt could remember. The clean word for them was zombies. Whatever they were called, Matt thought they deserved pity, not hatred. He couldn't bring himself to think about Celia and Tamlin. Sorrow threatened to overwhelm him, and he didn't want to be caught sobbing like a baby. Instead, he thought about going to San Luis. He'd look for the convent of Santa Clara right away and find Maria. The thought of Maria cheered him up immensely. Matt basked in the approval of his newfound friends. It was the most wonderful thing that had ever happened to him. The boys accepted him as though he were a real human. He felt like he'd been walking across a desert all his life, and now he'd arrived at the biggest and best oasis in the world. Chapter 28. The Plankton Factory. Raoul gave the boys an inspirational talk in the morning. It was all about aristocrats and how attractive they might seem on the surface, but how vile they really were inside. No mention was made of Matt. A few of the younger boys seemed uneasy, but Chacho and Fidelito proclaimed Matt a national hero after the keeper left. Matt was put to work the instant the talk was over. He was told to measure pills with the younger children, and his quota was twice theirs, to teach him the value of labor. Matt wasn't worried. When they reached San Luis, he'd be off to the convent faster than Fidelito could say, "It's hard, but it's fair." For breakfast, he was given only half a bowl of beans and three tortillas instead of six. Chacho told each of the bigger boys to give him a spoonful of theirs, so he wound up with a full bowl anyway. At mid-morning, Raoul called out the names of the three who were to go to San Luis and marched them to the hovercraft.
"You've had it easy here," he told them. "This is a holiday camp compared to where you're going. But if you work hard and keep your record clean, you can move up to full citizenship when you reach 18.
"Crat that," muttered Chacho.
"That's not a good beginning. That's not a good beginning at all," said Raoul.
Matt had been inside a hovercraft only once, the disastrous night when he'd been betrayed by Stephen and Emilia. This ship wasn't nearly as nice. It was full of hard plastic seats, and it smelled of sweat and mold. Raoul sat them in the middle, as far from the windows as possible. He gave them a bag of plastic strips to weave into sandals.
"Told you we'd have to work," said Chacho under his breath.
The keeper strapped them in and left without a word. The rest of the hovercraft was filled with bales of plastic sandals piled so high the boys couldn't see out the windows. They couldn't move around either because the straps were locked into place.
"What is it with these people?" thought Matt.
They couldn't seem to relax unless they had total control. The hovercraft lifted, and Fidelito announced that he always got sick on airships.
"You barf on me, you've had it," snarled Chacho.
Matt solved the problem by transferring the bag of plastic strips to the little boy's lap.
"You're a genius," said Chacho. "Go ahead, Fidelito. Knock yourself out."
What were Stephen and Emilia doing now? Matt wondered as they flew on. Stephen was the crown prince of opium now. He'd be celebrating. His friends from school would come over, and tables would be set in the garden where El Patron used to have his birthday parties. Emilia would have her Egypt flower girls to wait on her. Or perhaps she'd sent them away to the fields. They weren't capable of much else. "Those girls must have tried to run with their parents," Matt thought with a thrill of horror. They weren't any older than Fidelito, who had lost his battle with air sickness and was coating the plastic strips in second-hand beans and tortillas.
"They should have starved you at breakfast time," said Chacho.
"I can't help it,"
said Fidelito in a muffled voice. The rest of the trip, mercifully short,
was spent in a cloud of sour vomit. Matt leaned one way and Chacho leaned the other in a vain attempt to escape the smell. Fortunately, the hovercraft landed soon. When the pilot saw what had happened, he unlocked the seatbelts and shoved the boys out the door. Matt tumbled to his knees on hot sand. He sucked in air and immediately regretted it. The smell outside was even worse. It was like thousands of fish rotting and oozing in the hot sun. Matt gave in to the inevitable and emptied his stomach. Not far away, Chacho was doing the same.
I was in purgatory. Now I'm in hell, he groaned.
Make it stop, sobbed Fidelito.
Matt pulled himself to his feet and dragged the little boy toward a building shimmering in the heat. All around, Matt saw blinding white hills and crusted pools stained with crimson. Chacho stumbled after them. Matt pulled Fidelito through a doorway and slumped against a wall to recover. The air inside was cooler and slightly fresher. The room was full of bubbling tanks, tended by boys who morosely fished the water with nets and who paid no attention to the newcomers. After a few moments, Matt felt strong enough to get up. His legs were rubbery, and his stomach was in knots. "Who's in charge?" he asked. A boy pointed at a door. Matt knocked and went in. He saw a group of men dressed in the same black uniform as Raúl, with the emblem of a beehive on their sleeves.
"There's one of los bichos, the vermin who stank up my hovercraft," said the pilot.
"What's your name?" said a keeper.
"Matt Ortega," Matt replied.
"Ah, the aristocrat."
Uh-oh, thought Matt. Raúl must have spread the word. "Well, you won't get away with your swanky ways here," the man said.
"We've got something called the boneyard, and any troublemaker who goes through it comes out as harmless as a little lamb."
"The first thing he's going to do is clean my ship," said the pilot.
And so Matt, along with Chacho, soon found himself scrubbing the floors and walls of the aircraft. Lastly, and most horribly, they had to wash each slimy strip of plastic in a bucket of hot, soapy water. The air didn't smell as evil as before.
"It's just as bad," the pilot assured them from his seat under a plastic shade. "The longer you're here, the less you notice it. There's something in it that paralyzes your sense of smell."
"We should make Fidelito drink this,"
said Chacho, idly sloshing the contents of the bucket. "He can't help it," Matt said. Poor Fidelito had curled up on the ground in a fit of misery. Neither boy had the heart to make him work. After they finished, the head keeper, who was called Carlos, gave them a tour of the factory.
"These are the brine tanks," he said. "You take the stink bugs out of the tanks with this."
He held up a net.
"And when the plankton's ripe, you harvest it."
"What's plankton?" Matt ventured to ask.
"Plankton," exclaimed Carlos, as though he'd been waiting eagerly for that question.
"It's what a whale filters out of the sea to make a meal. It's the microscopic plants and animals that drift in the top layer of the water. You wouldn't think an enormous creature could live on something so tiny, but that's the astonishing truth. Plankton is the eighth wonder of the world. It's full of protein, vitamins, and roughage. It's got everything a whale needs to be happy, and everything people need, too. The plankton we manufacture here is made into hamburgers, hot dogs, and burritos. Ground up fine, it takes the place of mother's milk."
Carlos went on and on. It appeared his life's work was to make people love and appreciate plankton. He seemed blind to the bleak desert that surrounded them now that they had gone outside. Matt saw high security fences in the distance, and his heart sank. The air was foul, the temperature broiling, and the humidity so high that his jumpsuit clung to his body like a second skin. This was the place he was supposed to inhabit until he turned 18. "Where's San Luis?" he asked.
"That's on a need-to-know basis," said Carlos. "When we feel you need the information, that's when you get to know it. Don't get any ideas about going over the fence, either. The top wire has enough power to spit you back like a melon seed. Here are the Salt Mountains."
He indicated the white dunes Matt had noticed before.
After we harvest the plankton, the brine is evaporated and salt is processed for sale. These are the highest salt mountains in the world. People come from all over to admire them. What people? Thought Matt, looking at the depressing landscape. A siren wailed. Time for the first lunch setting, Carlos said. He led them up a dune. It was more solid than it looked. At the top was a picnic area with tables. Plastic flowers were planted around the edge, and a weather vane topped by a spouting whale stood in the center. A slight breeze blew a fine dusting of salt over Matt's skin. The lunch area was my idea, Carlos said, plopping himself onto a bench. I think it's raised everyone's morale. The boys, trudging up the slope with pots and dishes, didn't look especially happy. They set down their burdens and lined up between the tables like rows of soldiers. Carlos told Matt, Chacho, and Fidelito to stand at the end of a line. Everyone recited the 5 principles of good citizenship and the 4 attitudes leading to right mindfulness, and then a sullen, acne-scarred boy began dishing up.
What is your stuff? Said Chacho, sniffing his bowl.
Delicious, nutritious plankton, the boy growled.
Everything a whale needs to be happy, said another, pretending to gag.
They straightened up when Carlos gave them a sour look. I will not have you insulting food, the keeper said. Food is a wonderful thing. Millions of people have died because they did not have enough, and you lucky boys get to eat your fill 3 times a day. In the old days, aristocrats feasted on roast pheasant and suckling pig, while the peasants had to eat grass and tree bark. In the new Aztlan, everything is shared equally. If only one person is deprived of roast pheasant and suckling pig, the rest of us should refuse to eat them. Plankton is the most delicious dish in the world when it is shared by all. No one said anything after that. Matt guessed he was the only one there who'd actually feasted on roast pheasant and suckling pig. For the life of him, he couldn't see why plankton was supposed to taste better if everyone was stuck with it. It was sticky and crunchy at the same time, and it coated his mouth like rancid glue. From the high plateau, the guard fence was visible. Matt squinted his eyes into the blinding light, but he couldn't see much beyond it. He thought he saw a glint of water far to the west.
That's the Gulf of California, said Carlos, shading his eyes as he followed Matt's gaze.
Are there whales in it? Matt asked.
They'd have to bring their own bathtubs, a boy said.
Carlos looked sorrowful.
There used to be whales. Once, this whole area was covered by water.
He pointed at a ridge of hills to the east.
That was the coastline. Through the years, the water flowing from the Colorado River got so polluted, the whales died.
What happened to the Gulf? Asked Chacho.
That's one of the great engineering triumphs of Aztlan, Carlos said proudly. We diverted the Colorado River to an underground canal that runs into dreamland. Once the pollutants were removed, we started harvesting the Gulf for plankton. Fresh seawater comes in from the south, but what with harvesting and the loss of river water, the Gulf has shrunk to a narrow channel.
So that was where opium's water came from, Matt realized. A river so polluted that it could kill a whale. He wondered whether El Patron had known about it. Yes, probably, Matt decided. The water was free, and El Patron loved a bargain. After lunch, Matt, Chacho, and Fidelito were put to work tending the brine shrimp tanks. These stretched in a long line to the west of the central factory, with a pipeline for water running to one side. The shrimp filled up the tanks in a pulsing, squirming mass. They gobbled red algae until their bodies turned the color of blood. It was this that had stained the pools Matt had noticed when he first arrived. He found the job interesting. He liked the busy little creatures, and thought their tiny bodies, rippling with feathery gills, were every bit as nice as flowers. He and the others sieved out insects and added water as needed. There were, unfortunately, miles of tanks, and thousands of suicidal bugs. After a few hours, Matt's arms ached, his back was stiff, and his eyes burned from salt. Fidelito whimpered to himself as they trudged along. The desert stretched ahead of them without so much as a dead tree for shade. The tanks seemed to be heading for the distant channel Matt had seen during lunch.
It was definitely blue now, not merely a flash of light on the horizon. The water looked cool and deep.
"Can you swim?" he asked Chacho.
"Where would I learn a swanky thing like that?" Chacho got mean when he was tired. Matt knew that swanky meant something only an evil, rotten, spoiled aristocrat would do.
"I know how to swim," announced Fidelito.
"Where'd a puny loser like you pick it up? In a shrimp tank?" snarled Chacho. Instead of getting angry, Fidelito treated the suggestion seriously. Matt had noticed that the little boy was amazingly good-natured. He might wet the bed and barf at the drop of a hat, but his goodwill more than made up for it.
"I am puny, aren't I? I could probably swim in these tanks."
"Yeah, and the shrimp would eat your weenie off." Fidelito cast a startled look at Chacho.
"Oh," he said, "I didn't think of that."
"Where did you learn to swim?" Matt asked, to change the subject.
"Mi abuelita taught me in Yucatan. We lived on the seashore."
"Was it nice?"
"Was it?" cried Fidelito. "It was heaven. We had a little white house with a grass roof. My grandma sold fish at the market, and she took me out in a canoe on holidays. That's why she taught me to swim, so I wouldn't drown if I fell overboard."
"If it was so great, why did she run for the border?" Chacho said.
"It was a storm," the little boy said. "It was a hurry.
"A hurricane?" Matt guessed.
"Yes, and the sea came in and took everything away. We had to live in a refugee camp."
"Oh," said Chacho, as though he instantly understood.
"We had to live in a big room with a lot of other people, and we had to do everything at the same time, in the same way. There weren't any trees, and it was so ugly that mi abuelita got sick. She wouldn't eat, so they force-fed her."
"It is the duty of every citizen to survive and contribute to the general good," said Chacho. "I've had that yelled at me a couple million times."
"Why wouldn't they let your grandma go back to the seashore?" asked Matt.
"You don't understand," Chacho said. "They kept her locked up so they could help her. If they turned all the poor suckers loose, there'd be no one left to help, and then there wouldn't be any point to a crotting keeper's life."
Matt was astounded. It was the craziest thing he'd ever heard. And yet, it made sense. Why else were the boys locked up? They'd run away if someone left the door open.
"Is all of Aztlan like this?"
"Of course not," said Chacho. "Most of it's fine, but once you fall into the hands of the keepers, you're lost. See, we're certified losers. We don't have houses or jobs or money, so we have to be taken care of."
"Did you grow up in a camp?" Fidelito asked Matt. It was an innocent question, but it opened the door to things Matt didn't want to talk about. Fortunately, he was saved by the arrival of Carlos in a little electric cart. It purred up so silently, the boys didn't notice it until it was almost upon them.
"I've been watching you for 15 minutes, said Carlos. "You've been loafing."
"The heat was getting to Fidelito," Chacho said quickly. "We thought he was going to faint."
"Eat salt," Carlos told the little boy. "Salt is good for everything. You should turn back now or you won't make it home before dark."
He started to go off.
"Wait, can you take Fidelito?" Chacho said. "He's really tired."
Carlos stopped and backed up.
"Boys, boys, boys, hasn't anyone told you labor is shared equally among equals? If one person has to walk, everyone has to."
"You're not walking," Matt pointed out. Carlos' grin vanished instantly.
"So the aristocrat presumes to lecture us about equality," he said. "The aristocrat is only a snot-faced boy who thinks he's too good for the rest of us. I am a true citizen. I've earned my privileges through hard work and obedience. No food for you tonight."
"Crop that," said Chacho.
"No food for any of you. You'll learn to obey the will of the people if it takes the next 50 years.
Carlos rode off in a plume of dust and salt.
"I'm sorry, Fidelito," said Chacho. "You didn't deserve to be lumped in with the two of us."
"I'm proud to be with you," the little boy cried. "You're my compadres. Crop Carlos. Crop the keepers."
Fidelito looked so fierce, with his scrawny chest thrust out and revolution blazing from every pore, that both Matt and Chacho broke down with hysterical laughter. Chapter 29. Washing a Dusty Mind. "Why does everyone keep calling me the aristocrat?" asked Matt as they trudged back along the line of shrimp tanks. Chacho wiped the sweat from his face with the sleeve of his jumpsuit.
I don't know. It's how you talk, partly, and you're always